This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. So while you're cleaning up the cake and the champagne bottles, do you remember that bold resolution you made to change your life? And whether that involves a spiritual quest, killer abs, financial independence, or a garage you can actually park your car in, there's bound to be a shiny book or video lurking in the self-help aisle. Skeptic Beth Lissick avoided that aisle like poison, but 2 New Years ago, she made an unusual decision to step outside her comfort zone and seek self-improvement, not just with gusto, but with goals. But which guru to choose? She spent a year wending her way through 10 of the most popular and most popularly scorned self-help tomes of our time, Men Are From Mars, Seven Habits, Deepak Chopra, and yes, she went on a cruise with Richard Simmons. And Beth Lissick's book about her year combining, combing the self-improvement aisle is called Helping Me Help Myself, One Skeptic, 10 Self-Help Gurus, and a Year on the Brink of the Comfort Zone. If you've enlisted the help of a Tony Robbins or a Susie Orman, if you're debating which path to take at the moment, our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Beth Lissick joins us now from the studios of member station KALW in San Francisco, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Neil.
And your book begins just where we are now, January 1st, 2 years ago. So set the scene for us.
Well, we have a New Year's Eve party every year, and I woke up in my bed and I was looking at the cracks on the ceiling, and I was looking at the screws where our smoke detector should have been hanging for the past few years. And I just started thinking, God, there are a lot of things around here that I could improve, but I'd never made a New Year's resolution. And like you said, I was completely skeptical of anything near the self-help aisle at the bookstore. So I think because I'm a writer and because I like to kind of push the limits of my comfort zone, I thought, why don't I just face my fears head on and just go for it and just try to spend this entire year improving as much as I could.
You describe that aisle as the intersection of sincerity, curiosity, revulsion, and sheer desire to improve my life. But you also entered that aisle with, well, something between skepticism and snarkiness. Is that fair to say?
Well, I don't, you know, it's too easy a subject to make fun of. And so that was really challenging for me because, yeah, I went on a cruise with Richard Simmons. It's a regular Carnival cruise ship with 2,000 people on board, 225, which were Richard's group. And I thought, how am I going to approach this having fun with it, but actually trying to understand these people and figure this out? So I tried not to be snarky. You know, I really tried to be sincere and see what I could do. But it's also, I mean, it's funny. You're doing aerobics on a cruise ship. I mean, so there's a lot of humor in the book, but hopefully not mean-spirited.
Somebody describes the Richard Simmons cruise to lose as the tyranny of fun.
Yeah, well, that is one of the mottos on the Carnival cruise ships. That's how I interpreted it.
Your interpretation.
It's a fun ship. It's all about fun all the time. And it really did sort of seem like a tyranny of fun by the third or fourth day. It was a week-long cruise. It's a long time to be on a ship.
Yet, despite your skepticism about a lot of things, you came to, it seems to me, honestly, like Richard Simmons and what he was doing for these mostly women who are on the cruise. You point out that one of the meanings of the word guru is the slayer of darkness. And Richard Simmons was that for you?
Yeah, he really was, because I got to spend the most time with Richard. I did follow the advice of 10 gurus during this year, but I did get a full week with Richard on the high seas. And I think that I saw a lot of different sides of him, and I saw the really extremely campy side that we see on TV. But then I also saw the way that he interacts with his followers, and he gets as much from them as they get from him. And so that was really interesting to see that close up. And I think that, to me, slaying that darkness was what I saw was kind of taking away that cheesiness and seeing a real person there, which I didn't get to do with everybody. But with Richard, I definitely did.
And has any of his advice stuck with you?
Well, you know, I did sweat to the oldies. I did party off the pounds a little bit with some of his videos. But, you know, I hadn't exercised in 20 years. And so for me, when I chose that month, the health and fitness month, I thought, what other fitness guru is there in the United States that's as long running and as well known as Richard, besides Jack LaLanne, who's like 93 now, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think doing cruises, or at least not anymore. We're talking with Beth Lissick. Her new book is called Helping Me Help Myself. If you've ever engaged the book of one of the great self-help gurus, the popular ones, give us a call, 800-989-8255. And especially if you made that decision on, well, New Year's Day. Again, the phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Beth Lissick, I wanted to ask you, I guess the first person you went with was Jack Chicken Soup for the Soul Canfield.
That is correct. He had a book out at the time called The Success Principles, How to Get from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. And part of the thing about these gurus and about the self-help thing is just all the language around it had turned me off for years and years and years. I mean, I used to watch Tony Robbins with my friends when I was a teenager, you know, at night, and just we'd just be laughing. And so I pick up a book like that, and would you believe me, Neil, if I actually followed some advice in the book and envisioned myself having this conversation with you during this year, I thought, you know what, if I write a book about this, I could go on Talk of the Nation and talk to Neil Conan. And that is actually a thing that I really thought 2 years ago while I was reading his book, because that's part of his philosophy is just, you know, if you picture in your mind's eye what you want. And it was so against my nature to do any of this. But this is a hilarious example of something that I actually said, all right, I'm going to put this in my goals binder. And a goals binder. I mean, I never thought I would have one.
We want to see a copy of that goals binder notarized and dated.
I know. And I was supposed to learn how to make pork chops really well, too. That was in my goals binder, but I didn't get that one yet.
And do the splits on both sides.
Yeah, that was from the talent show that we have at our New Year's Eve party. This is how it all really started, is that I thought I could do the splits on one side, and I had done it for the talent show. And when I had woken up on New Year's Day, I thought, God, you know what? Next year, I'll learn how to do the splits on the other side, and it'll be way more show busy and funny. And then that's when I realized that I had just made my first and only New Year's resolution. So that year started out with that was going to be my only resolution for the whole year. And that's when I realized it was kind of pathetic that was my only goal.
Pretty limited goals, yeah.
Yeah.
What was it about you, about your personality, do you think, that sort of kept you out of that self-help aisle for all those years?
You know, I think that there is something about just being able to take care of stuff on my own, thinking that I could do it on my own, that Emersonian idea of self-reliance and I don't need anybody else. And I think a lot of it, too, is just the commerce around it is really unappealing and unattractive. And looking at these, you know, kind of tan men with perfectly coiffed hair and just thinking, how could that relate to my life in any way? And so I don't think I'm a jerk, but I definitely was very turned off by it. And just kind of from the outside looking at it, just how it felt, how cheesy it felt.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, email is talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Dr. Tom. And Dr. Tom with us from Nindon in Nevada.
Yes, hi, Neil. Hi, Beth. Good morning.
And Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. You know, Beth, I just wanted to comment that I got a kick out of what you've been saying so far. I'm looking forward to reading your book in the sense that I'm 54 years old, and I think I've done everything that you're describing times 10. When I was in college, I was a psychology major, and ever since I've been really interested in, you know, how to, if you can even use the word, improve one's life. So I understand both the attraction and at the same time that skepticism, almost repulsion.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, and I think that once you get in there and sort through it all, there's some great ideas, and I actually did learn a lot of things. I mean, I called up, you know, I followed Susie Orman's advice and called up my credit card company and got my APR reduced from something ridiculous like 20% to 0% for an entire year in 2 minutes with a phone call. Just stuff like that. I read it in the book and just never thought of doing it myself. So there are a lot of things if you sift through.
Well, you know, if I can make one comment, one thing I discovered, and this is a personal observation, is that One can almost become addicted to self-help in that one reads the books and listens to the tapes and goes to the seminars. And I had this sort of personal epiphany that, in the sense that at some point I realized, you know what? I just put down those books and tapes for years, where I realized I just have to live this stuff. I mean, I would go to seminars and I would almost predict what the next sentence was going to be.
Yeah, I did find, you know, I read the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That was the second book that I read in my year of self-help. And I really think that that is actually a good self-help book that you could just read that one. There really could just be that book, I do believe. It's kind of bare bones and basic, and all the ideas are in there. And it's interesting to me to see how the personalities of the gurus come out. And some people identify with certain people or think, oh, this is going to be my person, you know. And well, that book's terrible, but try this guy. He's the best one.
Well, though you asked yourself while reading the Stephen Covey book, is it wrong to ask a self-help book to help you improve your character?
Yeah, to me, it seems like the idea that there's a plan and a guideline, follow these, you know, 7 habits or the 9 steps to financial freedom, the, you know, these 4 things, these are the rules. And so it does seem counterintuitive that you would be reading a book that is telling you how to be a better person when the ideas are so very basic.
And I have I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Tom.
Neil, I was just going to make one more comment, and that's very apropos what you said, Neil, about the character issue. I've been to these seminars where I've gotten to know some of these people firsthand, some of these what we call gurus, and, you know, it's so fascinating. There's one famous guy, and I don't want to name his name, but he's written a book on relationships and, you know, amongst many other self-help books, and I've seen him cheat on his wife, so I'm going, who are you? You know, when you see these people up close and personal, you realize that they're more than human. And that's, in one hand, that could be a turnoff. But on the other hand, you go, hey, they've got nothing over me. You know, you just realize you've got to live your own life and not to put anybody on a pedestal. Take what you can and just use it in a way that Beth was saying, like the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Take what you get, but don't put these people on a pedestal, because they're really no better than you or I.
Okay, Dr. Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks so much.
Beth, did you ever find out who Franklin Covey was?
Oh, right. I did. Stephen Covey merged his business with Franklin Industries. So that's how it turned into this Franklin Covey as we know it, the store at the mall where you can get the planners. So I did go to a Franklin Covey symposium in Chicago for a few days, and there were a lot of Franklin Covey products also there for sale. But the funniest thing they had also at that seminar was a company called Executive Book Summaries, which was one of the conference sponsors. And what they do is they take these business books and they condense, you know, a 400-page business book down to its essentials. So it's like 3 paragraphs long. And I noticed that they had taken Stephen Covey's latest book, The 8th Habit, which is actually a longer book than The 7 Habits. So I haven't read that one yet, but it's 1 habit takes up more room than 7
in the previous 7
book.
Well, must be a really good
habit.
Yeah,
and anyway, they had taken the 8th habit though and condensed it down to 2 paragraphs. So they were trying to sell the book on one hand, but then also you could just pick up a pamphlet with the 2 paragraphs, and it was all boiled down for you.
We're talking with Beth Listick about her new book, Helping Me Help Myself, One Skeptic, 10 Self-Help Gurus, and a Year on the Brink of the Comfort Zone. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is going to be Julia. Julia with us from Eugene, Oregon.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, please. Happy New Year.
Okay, Happy New Year to you, too. I wanted to talk about that Joseph Campbell phrase, following your bliss.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what I decided to do a few years ago. I realized I was really far from where I wanted to be. And I decided to take that seriously, even though it's such a pithy comment, you know. But my life has just turned around 180 degrees, and the thing that really works for me about him is he seems to encourage me to really listen to that deep inner voice. You know, he doesn't sort of tell me what to do so much as I feel like tells me how to listen to what it is that's really inside, you know.
And you feel like this has made a tremendous difference in your life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just feel like I was really far from where I wanted to be, and you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about was how scary it can be to sort of become the person that you want to be if it's so unfamiliar to you. If you've been living your life and kind of going the wrong direction for a really long time, you can turn it around and it'll feel really good. But on the other hand, it's kind of really challenging, too, because it's so unfamiliar.
Yeah, you also have to commit to it. And it's interesting. Thanks very much for the call and good continued good luck with your pursuits.
Thank you very much.
But you have to commit to it. And in one of the, I forget which chapter you were writing about, Beth Lissick, you said, you know, if this program is to succeed or if any of these programs are to succeed, I have to be dedicated. I have to be committed to this.
It's true. Because I found myself, you know, a whole year doing this was really exhausting. And so there are times, so it chronicles my year, and I kind of start to flag at points and just think, God, I don't know if this is for me. And, you know, like what the caller said, having this idea of following your bliss, it's interesting because it's almost like if you just think of that, I don't know that I needed a book to tell me that. I could maybe read the title and just sit there and think about it, following your bliss. Okay, following what's inside. And I think that in daily life, it's hard to keep doing those things when you're distracted by people cutting you off in traffic or, you know, all the things like that.
And small children, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which you have had and have in the course of
writing
this book.
Yeah. No, that was an interesting chapter. That was probably the most unhumorous of all of my chapters because I have, at the time, my son was 4 years old and he was going through this terrible testing time where I found this guy at actually a different seminar. I was at to see John Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and I found this guy, Thomas Phelan, Dr. Phelan, who has written a book called 1-2-3 Magic. And it's this very slim book on disciplining your child. And it was so basic and simple. And I actually found that it really, really worked. And that was probably one of the top ones that I did that year, was just learning this advice on how to discipline my child. And again, it's not a very funny chapter because I go through, you know, the temper tantrums and the frustration and all that of being a parent.
It's New Year's Day, a time for resolutions and gurus to help your resolve. And give us a call to help to tell us what self-help tones you've consulted over the years. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can check out what listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We're talking with Beth Lissick about her year of self-improvement. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And right now we're continuing our conversation with Beth Lissick, who spent a whirlwind year sampling the pleasures and pains of self-improvement with a gaggle of gurus. You can read an excerpt from her book, Helping Me Help Myself, One Skeptic, 10 Self-Help Gurus, and A Year on the Brink of the Comfort Zone. That's at our website at npr.org/talk. And if you've ever consulted a guru or pored over a self-help book, let us know how it worked for you. You're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and again, our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Beth Lissick, I have to ask you, you were talking about being motivated by Susie Orman to call the credit card company and have your rate reduced, which was, I guess, a variation on I think it was Jack Canfield's suggestion of, you know, just ask for what you want. And
yeah, that's right. That's one of Jack's one of his success principles is just ask, 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 and keep asking. And in the beginning of the book, I try to get him to give me free e-coaching to be my life coach for free. Mm-hmm. And I just ask, and I just kept getting rejected.
Well, I'm sorry about
but
that. But
I know. But in the end, I did get a lot from Jack, but it didn't work in that case. But in the credit card thing, it was interesting because it really was a 2-minute phone call. So that in that case, it worked out really well.
I wonder, you see a lot of parallels between even, you know, Richard Simmons, who you wouldn't necessarily think of being in the same category as, say, Deepak Chopra, but nevertheless, the same kinds of advice filtering through all of these different channels.
Yeah, you know what I found very interesting was when I did my home organization month, I consulted Julie Morgenstern, who's Oprah's go-to lady. And it was her book is called Organizing from the Inside Out. And a lot of it is about, takes these ideas of kind of going a little bit deeper and figuring out, well, why is your closet a mess? And I just thought, I've just got a messy closet. I don't know. I can't keep this stuff organized. And then when I read her book, I thought, you know, it really is because I've always been sort of ambivalent about fashion. I like, you know, old vintage clothes, but I think it's kind of ridiculous to be really into fashion and spend a lot of time on your appearance. And so I realized that, you know, according to Julie's philosophy, that was why my closet was a mess, is because I didn't take care of my clothes because I didn't really put much value in them.
There was another philosophy. So, a friend of yours came in and said, you two have just kept everything that you thought was funny when you were 20.
Yeah, that's true. That's yeah. A friend did say that to us when he went down in our basement, which is sort of the where we put everything that we don't want to look at anymore. And he did notice that, you know, we had a lot of like huge portraits of families from the 1960s that aren't related to us. And yeah, things we thought were hilarious at one time and are still in our basement.
And after that book and realizing the cogence of her advice, is the basement clean?
You know, Neil, the basement is not clean. I'm sorry to say it, but I'm going on a book tour and my husband has taken some time off work and that's actually his going to be his job. So it's, you know, 2 years later and we're still working on it here. But it's good because I actually got, like, for the home organization thing, Julie gave me a whole plan, a master plan. And I got the closets, I got some of the cabinets done, and then I still have this thing to look at of what I can do. So I put the basement off on my husband.
Let's get some more callers in on the conversation. Let's turn to this is MJ. MJ with us from Potter Valley in California.
And a happy new year to you and to your guests.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, I was in the garage getting it straight. We can get one car in the two-car garage, and I'm resound to get that straightened away. But the reason for the call, if I can just kind of jump right in, from my standpoint, I'm not quite 60 years of age, and the guru in my life has been my father, who incidentally was and remains a dear friend of Jack LaLanne. A matter of fact, they used to work out together at the YMCA in San Francisco in the 30s. And my father today, Max is his name, retired inspector from the police department in San Francisco, is the same age as Jack. I think they're about 4 months apart, born in 1914. He still does 10 push-ups every day, and I'm talking military push-ups. I have a tough time keeping up with my dad, God love him. And he has some tenets that he lives by. First of all, he says, son, love everybody. And I said, Dad, that's impossible. He says, it's not impossible. If you can't love them, at least forgive them. And never give up. So he lives by that, and I'd like to add that there are many excellent books on the market, but certain principles kind of remain true. You have to be true to yourself, and those that love you need to be loved in return. I haven't had an occasion to read your book, Beth, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well,
thank you so much. That is a great point, though, is getting inspiration from the people around you and people that you know. And yeah, taking those really basic ideas and not, I guess that I would kind of, you know, you write them off as cliches because we hear them so often, treat others, you know, do unto others, the whole golden rule. And if you think about it, when you walk around and you're, and I mean, then it gets into the whole thing about the secret, too, right? If you're projecting all this positive energy, it's going to come back to you. You know, that was the book, and that came out at the end of my year, so I didn't have to tackle The Secret, though Jack Canfield did hand me a copy of the film when I met him. But I think it is true that you can get so much inspiration from people around you and people who set good examples of how to live their lives.
Very true.
And MJ, I think we can safely say that most of us would have a hard time keeping up with your dad and with Jack LaLanne.
you know, I agree. And he's still a member in good standing of a health club in Ukiah. And he has saved many people's lives, people that unfortunately feel down. They feel crippled because their muscles are they're not standing straight. And my father, I can't tell you and your listeners how much I respect and love Max. I see him every week. My wife and I live in just outside of Santa Rosa, and we have a home in Ukiah. But the long and short of it is an inspiration for me to be with my father, because so many people, and I mean this sincerely, come to the house, or when they see him either at the health club, they gravitate to him because he is a positive person. No matter how much pain he has been in, and let me say, he was shot a couple of times. I remember as a kid when he was in the police department, he was in the robbery detail. He came home bloodied, but he went right back out and solved the crime in most cases. So a positive mental outlook on life is very healing to one's psyche and to one's soul.
MJ, have you ever considered writing a self-help book?
I said we should get your dad a book deal.
Well, you know, that's thank you. I'll mention that to him. it may very well be, and I'd be more than happy to discuss his outlook of life with
you. Well, our people will be in touch with your people, MJ.
Hey, you know, thank you very much for the opportunity of sharing with both of you folks and with your audience to keep a positive mental outlook on life. And to keep smiling. If nothing else, it keeps those that are looking at you off guard.
Thanks very much.
All right.
And a Happy New Year to you and your dad.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's turn now to Catherine. And Catherine's calling us from Salt Lake City.
Hi.
Hi. And Happy New Year.
I want to meet that guy's dad.
I know.
the message that he spoke of positive mental attitude and also self-love kind of came into play in the book that I read, too. The book I read is called The Dance of Anger, and I read it a long time ago when I was a young woman with three young children, small children, and I was married to an abusive spouse. He really was a very angry and mean man, and I felt trapped, and I didn't know what to do.
And the Dance of Anger helped you?
It did. I was angry. I mean, I was in a relationship where I was angry because somebody was, you know, throwing me into walls and, you know, being abusive with money and just trying to abuse power in a relationship. And I realized that my anger wasn't getting me anywhere. And so I the book helped me get in touch with who I was as a person and helped me make positive choices. And pretty soon, he became intolerant of my behavior to him because I wasn't responding to his use of power anymore, and he left me.
Yeah, well, you know, that's in a lot of these books too, is that you cannot choose, you know, you can't control how other people are going to act to you, but you have the choice, the power to choose how you react to them.
I know, it was exactly, and I had read this book, and you know, there was an event where he did harmed me physically. I called my father. My father said, "Catherine, that's assault. Call the police." And it snapped, and something in my head just snapped. And, you know, that was the beginning of the end of the marriage. I just wouldn't tolerate his abuse anymore, and I wouldn't be angry, and I wouldn't react to him, and I wouldn't cower. And he just one day walked out. And by then I was so, I didn't love him because of the awful way he had treated me in the, you know, the bad, you know, he was a bad force in the lives of my children, too. And I basically said, "Don't take the good towels," and goodbye. And then he left. And, you know, since then, he hasn't been a great father, but he has a good, positive relationship with his children. And I never see him or talk to him, but I'm not angry at him anymore. And I really credit this book. It was a wonderful book, The Dance of Anger by Harriet Goldhoer-Lerner, and she's a psychotherapist. And the book was written in 1985, so it's not a new book, and I don't even know if there are newer versions of the book, but I loved it. And then there was a subsequent book, too, and I've forgotten the title, but The Dance of Anger changed my life. It really did.
Well, Catherine, congratulations. It's not easy.
Thanks.
Appreciate the phone call, too. And again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
We're talking with Beth Lissick about her book, Helping Me Help Myself. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Beth, I wanted to ask you, at the end of your book, you conclude after a year, and it wasn't one guru per month exactly, you took a couple of months off to, was that to plow through the depths of self-doubt?
You know, I had a couple things that I wanted to do, and when I got to those months, I thought it would be funny to try and improve my sex life. And then when I started thinking about how I was going to write about this and how I was going to consult someone to, and then my husband and I just decided, hey, why don't we just have sex more often? That'll work. And so that was that chapter.
That was that chapter. And Simon made some people very happy, too. But at the end of the year, back in January, you wrote, I thought it would be the funniest thing if I didn't improve at all, if I came to the conclusion that self-help programs were mostly a bunch of garbage. What conclusions did you come to?
You know, I think that there was something about stepping out of the way that I normally live my life, which really is this kind of low impact, go with the flow, in a way following my bliss, but that wasn't exactly working out in some areas. So when I stepped outside and actually started to, I mean, I'm not kidding, you know, visualize myself writing a book about it, going on Talk of the Nation, trying to make some sense out of it. In the end, I really did find that there were some good ideas, and it was useful for me to kind of step outside of the way that I normally think.
You spent a fair amount of money in pursuit of this, obviously, for the cruise with Richard Simmons.
Yeah, that was the downside.
Yeah, I was going to say, but also, you know, for the $699 for one seminar and the, I can't find my numbers, but several hundred dollars for another. And this can all add up. And that's even before you get to the what you delightfully describe as the merch desk.
Yeah, that I think that's the biggest downside, definitely. I spent my own money on it, and I go broke in the, you know, toward the end of the book. I mean, literally, I have no money. And, but I wanted to see what it felt like to do what people do and buy these books and then go to the seminar and spend that money on it. And, so yeah, I think that maybe if people read this book, they probably realize that they don't have to spend as much money as they are on all of these seminars, that a lot of the ideas are, you know, you can get a good used copy of an old self-help book.
Let's see, we get Jeff on the line. Jeff's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
I was just, the comment I want to make first, I wanted to ask if you had ever read As a Man Thinketh, which is, you know, credited as one of the first self-help books.
And, oh, no.
No, you haven't?
No, I haven't.
Okay. It was written in the late 1800s, and a lot of people turn to it as one of the first, think positively and everything will, you know, come true. But also, what is your take on the fact that there's such a proliferation of these books, and a lot of them wind up saying the same thing over and over again, and why are people turning to these, as opposed to what most people turned to a long time ago, which was, you know, organized religion?
Yeah, I find that very interesting, the whole idea of the life coach and the therapist kind of taking place of that. And I think that a lot of it is about packaging and marketing and that somebody, they're taking these old ideas and putting a new face on it. And somebody feels like, well, I'm not going to relate to Deepak Chopra, but maybe, you know, Stephen Covey's going to be my guy, or maybe I want somebody more religious, or maybe I want somebody a little warm and fuzzier. And so I think a lot of it is just, it's been discovered that this is a huge, huge money-making thing. And so I think that's what it is that they just keep turning around and putting a new face on it and those faces are going to resonate with certain people.
Yeah, I was interested to, you sort of end up dividing the whole category into two periods, 150 years of, self-help books, and then success writing, which comes of age after World War II.
Right. And Stephen Covey talks about that there was this idea about basic things about your character. That was sort of Benjamin Franklin, you know, wrote, or Emerson. And then it did turn into more of the kind of what you think of the pop psychology and, you know, yeah, put on a happy face and kind of these quick fix things are a more recent thing. And I think that's just a product of the culture.
Well, a friend of mine who gave me The Secret, who showed me that, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that, you know, you feel like saying, duh. But
well, there's a fair amount in all of those things you feel about saying,
yeah.
Duh.
Right. But the bottom line is that, you know, maybe because of our lives, we need to, you know, sometimes be reminded of it.
In a fresh way, in a way that's a little bit outside the box. Anyway, Jeff, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Have a good year.
And Beth Lissick, we're glad that we could empower your aura today.
Thank you so much.
Beth Lissick is the author of Helping Me Help Myself, One Skeptic, 10 Self-Help Gurus, and a Year on the Brink of the Comfort Zone. She joined us from the studios of KALW in San Francisco, California. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.